So tonight, I think this is the third. Is this the third class? The fourth class? I don't know. Okay, the fourth class of my basic Buddhist teachings series. And tonight we're talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. In case you just jumped into the series, there are recordings. We make recordings of the classes. You can listen, or there's a video. And that's those are there's just a volunteer who does that for each event, and then after a couple of days those are edited and posted to the website, so you can go listen to those if you want to start from the beginning. If somebody would like to pass these out, these are little Eightfold Path cheat sheets. And for those in the cloud, every time I touch the mouse pad, I shrink the Zoom screen. All right. I'm going to send a link. This is to, if you need it, if you want it, that's to a podcast page that I did on it. And like, you don't have to read the podcast page, but like the little table of contents just happens to list the Eightfold Path, because that's what the episode was on. So last week we talked about the Four Noble Truths. The first one being dukkha exists, and the point of the Four Noble Truths is that it is recommended that we experience each of them ourselves. So we explore for ourselves in what way stress and dissatisfaction is just kind of inherent in human life. And then the second truth is that that arises from our desire for things to be other than how they are, which is impermanent and inherently not self. And a simple way to think about that, I think, is like, you think of self as being, I mean, it's, if you really start to think about self, it's very difficult. Like, what do we even really mean by that? What is self? But kind of fundamentally, it means something we can control, you know, like something we are in control of, or at least influence and own. And essentially, it's saying nothing is like that. Everything is kind of ungraspable and empty of that kind of essence that we could hold on to. And that's, we don't want things to be that way. So we feel this kind of stress and dissatisfaction. And the third truth is that we can let go of that. Essentially, we can change our own minds and hearts. So we're more, we can just flow with reality more and not cause ourselves so much suffering and stress. And then the fourth truth is the Eightfold Path. So there's a path of practice that allows you to do those other things, right? To explore dukkha, the truth of dukkha, to recognize how it arises, and to let go of it, the causes. So the Eightfold Path, so we tend to, in Zen, we don't talk about it a lot. You know, it's like in practice, it's not like, oh yeah, that's right intention. That's, I mean, we do talk about right speech sometimes, but we don't tend to use this exact list or terminology so much. But all of the aspects of the Eightfold Path are present in our practice. All of them are very much present. And it's important to realize too, these aren't eight steps on a path. It's not a path, it's an eightfold path, right? It's a path that has eight aspects. Sometimes it's presented as like a wheel. If you ever see the wheel, Dharma wheel with eight spokes, each of those little spokes is for the one of these aspects. So it's a right view or understanding or knowing, right resolve or intention, right speech, right action or moral behavior, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and then right concentration or meditation. And the word right in this case is not a right versus wrong, kind of good versus bad moralistic thing. This is right as in it's what works. Like that's the right key to unlock that door. It's the, you know, so it's, yeah, it's efficacious, it's beneficial. That's what makes these things right. So like they're, even though they're not eight steps on a path, they're also cyclical and connected. So this is from the Pali Canon. So this is the collection of pretty much our most ancient collection of Buddhist texts, which have the word, the teachings of the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. And the Buddha is saying, he's addressing his monks, and he says, ignorance is the leader in the attainment of unskillful qualities, followed by lack of conscience and lack of concern. In an unknowledgeable person immersed in ignorance, wrong view arises. In one of wrong view, wrong resolve. In one of wrong resolve, wrong speech. In one of wrong speech, wrong action. In one of wrong action, wrong livelihood. One of wrong livelihood, wrong effort. In one of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness. One of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration. And then he says, the opposite, clear knowing is the leader in the attainment of skillful qualities, followed by confidence and concern. So he says, when right view arises, right resolve arises. Right resolve leads to right speech to right action to right livelihood to right effort, effort to mindfulness, and mindfulness to concentration. So there, even though we're doing all of these aspects at all the time, there is a sense in which they're also dependent on one another. So there is a sutta. So sutta is the Pali or Sanskrit word for what we usually say a sutra, words of the Buddha. This is the Magavibhanga Sutta, an analysis of the path. So it talks about the Eightfold Path in more specifics than the text we talked about before. And I'm not gonna read it all, it's very short. It's just two pages, but I'm as we go through the Eightfold Path, I'm going to be pulling parts out from this little sutta. In this path, this Eightfold Path, there's also three divisions. So the Indians are very, very fond of lists. So, you know, original Buddhism is just full of lists, interpenetrating lists. So the first division is wisdom. So the first is the right view or right understanding. And from this sutta, the Buddha says, and what, monks, is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress or dukkha. Knowledge with regard to the origination of stress. Knowledge with regard to the stopping of stress. Knowledge with regard to the way of practice leading to the stopping of stress. This, monks, is called right view. So the Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth. And the first aspect of the path is full understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So it's, again, we don't talk a lot about the Four Noble Truths. I mean, we talk about dukkha and stuff. But in Zen, we have a lot of focus on insight. Insight into, we tend to focus more on emptiness, on suchness. I talk about awakening to reality with a capital R. And in a way, these are just other ways to describe, you know, this, the Four Noble Truths describe reality with a capital R in a different way. Like, how does human suffering arise? Why does it arise? And what can we do about it? So these steps that we go through or these aspects we include, it's like over the course of practice, they become deeper and deeper. So it's interesting that this critical right understanding, right view is like the first one on the list, which in some ways is like, well, when you just start on the path, you're probably not going to have right view, right? That's like, then once you work on the path and you develop concentration and insight and all that, then you develop this right view. But in some senses, it's like when we start, the very sense of, there's a Buddhist term for it, samvega. It's not the dukkha dissatisfaction, but it's a dissatisfaction with our life. Like there's got to be a better way. So there's a certain kind of understanding and insight that we start to develop that brings us to practice. So that's why that's kind of at the beginning of the list. And then what is right resolve or intention? And from the sutta, the Buddha says, being resolved on renunciation, freedom from ill will, on harmlessness. This is called right resolve. So renunciation does not mean necessarily that we become monks and give everything up. This is renunciation, a spirit of renunciation for anything that we recognize, right, causes dukkha or suffering for self or other, right? Like we may get insight into it, but if we don't want to give it up, if we don't want to make any change, then the spokes of the wheel don't move. So we have to, you know, build up that willingness to let go of what actually causes suffering, to let go of self-attachment, etc. And then freedom from ill will and harmlessness. So these are counteracting another list of the three poisons. So greed or grasping, hate or aversion, and delusion. So these are seen as like, this is what's behind all unskillful actions, which, you know, you don't have to look very long or hard to realize that that's true. So these are kind of the antidotes, right? We're aspiring to recognize greed, grasping, aversion, and delusion in our lives and try to do something about it. So it's very interesting that this right intention, and you might think if right intention is part of the path, that somehow we have to kind of know what we're going for, or, you know, have our eyes set on enlightenment, or, you know, have the right plan. But that's not really what this is about. So this is another little sutta that I thought I would share a little bit of. So this is the Buddha saying, in the same way, any priests or contemplatives endowed with right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, of the Eightfold Path, if they follow the holy life, even when having made a wish for results, they are capable of obtaining results. If they follow the holy life, even when having made no wish, they are capable of obtaining results. If they follow the holy life, even when both having made a wish and having made no wish, they're capable of obtaining results. If they follow the life, even when neither having made a wish or nor having made no wish, they're capable of obtaining results. Why is that? Because it is an appropriate way of obtaining results. I mean, this is what's kind of attractive about these, you know, these original teachings. They're just very down to earth. They're just like, well, it's just an effective path. It doesn't really matter whether you're, you know, setting out to what, you know, you're fixated on any results or not. If you do it, you'll obtain results. So it's kind of sweet. So the second division is moral discipline. So the first is the wisdom part. That's the right understanding, right resolve. And then the second one is moral discipline. So many people assume that Buddhism is just like a philosophy, description of how suffering arises. And if you understand, you stand it, you might free yourself from it. So it's, you know, a technique based focused on individual liberation. And then morality is kind of extra, you know, maybe you'll become that way if you become wise. But this makes it clear from the very, very beginning, you know, if three aspects out of eight of the Eightfold Path have to do with your behavior, it's clear this is all part of a package. Our mind, our views affect our speech and actions. Our speech and actions affect our mind. And just imagine trying to meditate if you've just come from committing a crime. You know, good luck. I doubt it. So we need settled minds for this path, and acting out negative karma creates waves, creates remorse, or worry about being found out or whatever. It could creates turbulence in our lives. And you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, we end up making a much bigger deal out of compassionate action. I mean, I don't know about a bigger deal, but we start to say it's not just a practical thing, right? It's we're one with all beings, and we're interconnected, and compassion is a manifestation of that interconnection. And you know, so we go kind of woo-woo with all of it in Mahayana. But the Theravadins in particular are just, they're just very practical about it. It's just like, well, you're gonna suffer and make a mess of your life if you act in these ways. So in this moral division, we have right speech. And the Buddha says, what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, and abstaining from idle chatter. This, monks, is called right speech. So you'll see in that description several of our bodhisattva precepts reflected. We say not to lie. We say not to speak ill of others. We say to do not praise self and blame others. And then last week, this came up very briefly, so I thought I would bring it in. This wonderful, there's different versions in the Pali Canon, three tips, and this is one that has five criteria for deciding what is worth saying. And in case of the words that the Tathagata, so the Tathagata is another word for the Buddha. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be unfactual, untrue, unbeneficial, and in particular, we're thinking beneficial as connected, beneficial or not, as connected with the goal of liberation from suffering, spiritual development. Unendearing and disagreeable, he does not say them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, unbeneficial, unendearing, and disagreeable, he does not say them. So they're not beneficial. They may be true, but they're not going to be helpful. Then there's the case where he knows them to be factual, true, and beneficial, but endearing, unendearing, and disagreeable to others. Then he has a sense of a proper time for saying them. So it's true, it's going to be helpful, but then you're compassionate about when and how you express that. And then there's the case or, you know, to them to be unfactual, untrue, unbeneficial, but endearing and agreeable to others. He does not say them. And in the case where he knows them to be factual, true, unbeneficial, but endearing and agreeable, he does not say them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, beneficial, and endearing and agreeable, he has a sense of a proper time for saying them. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has sympathy for living beings. So I like to phrase this in terms of this is speech that is effective or beneficial. It's not about being right. It's like, that's usually our standard. It's like, well, I feel it. I think it's true. Here it is, you know, so blah. But is it going to be beneficial? Is it really necessary? And is this the right time? Then we have right action, abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from unchastity. This is called right action. So these are our precepts. We have three precepts that fit to this, and this is particularly having to do with our physical body. And right livelihood. What monks is right livelihood? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones, having abandoned dishonest livelihood, keeps his life going through right livelihood. Not very helpful, really. Okay. So there elsewhere, it describes a lay follower should not engage in five types of business. Which five? Business in weapons, business in human beings, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poison. So I suggest in our discussion tonight, we not get too hung up on what is a 2,500-year-old list of not the greatest livelihoods, right? But if we can look more at what the spirit of it is, do you have to be dishonest? Are you causing destruction? Whatever. And this is a really, really, it's a really tricky thing. And it's only become much, much, much more complex in the time that we're living in. You know, there's, especially if you extend livelihood, not just to how we make our money, how we make our living, but really to how we, you know, get the resources we need, how we invest, how we shop, how we do all of this is kind of, I think, pointing toward that economic and physical interaction with the world around us. And things have gotten to the point where, like, it's, you almost really can't live a pure lifestyle unless you really do just go off the grid. And then what help are you being? So this is a tricky one, but I think it's really interesting that this from the very beginning has been an acknowledgement that this has an effect on our spiritual state. This has an effect on our minds and bodies. Everything we do has an effect. And when we live in an ethical way, the Buddha says we have skillful virtues have freedom from remorse as their purpose. And then the idea is this is a list of things that as you are going more and more deeply into meditation, you know, freedom from remorse has joy as its purpose, joy as its reward. Joy has rapture, and it's rapture to serenity. Serenity to pleasure, not sensual pleasure, but a deep spiritual pleasure. Pleasure has concentration, and concentration has knowledge and vision of things. So this is our deeper insight. So it's seen as just a, you know, moral behavior is a prerequisite for any deep spiritual practice. And then finally, we have our third division, concentration or meditation. So this is direct mental training. So now we have right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration or meditation. So what is right effort? So this is the Buddha again. There is a case when a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates, persistence, upholds, and exerts his intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. He generates similar desire, endeavor, etc., an effort to abandon evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen. Generates similar effort for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities which have not yet arisen. And then he does a similar effort for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of spiritual qualities that have arisen. So we've got a lot to do. So Bhikkhu Bodhi says, this is what's interesting is energy or virya, the mental factor behind right effort, says can appear in either wholesome or unwholesome forms. The same factor fuels desire, aggression, violence, and ambition on the one hand, and generosity, self-discipline, kindness, concentration, and understanding on the other. So this is where, you know, these different aspects of the path interact. So when we have that right resolve, then we're aiming our right effort. And maybe we have the resolve, but unless we actually put the energy and the effort behind it, we're not going to make any progress. But we could put that energy and effort toward behind the wrong things as well. So our right view helps us discern what are the most useful things to put our energy into. And then right mindfulness. So mindfulness in this sense is different, or maybe I should say broader, than the popular concept of mindfulness. Mindfulness that is being taught in modern society, which is often extremely beneficial to people, is really just one kind of Buddhist mindfulness. It's generally mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of right here, right now, which is great. That's a great place to start, and it has benefits in and of itself. But mindfulness is like, I kind of where it's at. Right? The next stage is going to be meditative concentration, which we need to spend some time on. But mindfulness is the study of your life, of yourself, of your karma, of your behavior, of all of your experiences, and beginning to really see through them and understand them. So it begins with the body, but then it describes how the monk is aware when you're sitting down, where you're sitting down, when you're standing up, where you're standing, when you're walking, where you're walking, when you're drinking a drink of water, you're aware you're taking a drink of water. You're like building up this sati means gathered. It's like your attention is gathered to here. I've described it as like if you're trying to understand something, and like, are you trying to see something, right? See a bird and you have binoculars. Like mindfulness is like, oh yeah, I want to look at that bird. And it's like, it's bringing your, whatever it is that you are wanting to pay attention to concentrate on, is to bringing it back into your field of view. So it's learning how to direct our minds where we want them to go. Not in the sense of control, but in a sense of choice. So we explore the body, we explore feelings, like, dislike, indifference. Then we explore mind states. So this is in the four foundations of mindfulness. We explore, you know, feeling dull. Anger is arising in the mind. All the different things that arise in our minds, thoughts and feelings. And we, as we become aware of them, we also become a little bit detached from them in a way. Instead of I am angry, we become aware anger is arising in my mind. So mindfulness, this is from somebody else's description, but it's like keeping your eyes on the road as you're driving. And then we contemplate states of mind, and then we contemplate the Dharma. Then we contemplate the Four Noble Truths. We contemplate the teachings and try to see for ourselves whether they are true or not. And then finishing up is right concentration or right meditation. What the Buddha was talking about here, they would call dhyana, which is really pointing toward meditative absorption in a sense. In our form of Zen, our form of meditation is what I call a letting go practice, shikantaza, just sitting, rather than a directed effort practice, like concentrating the mind and, you know, coming back to a meditative object and disciplining the mind until you can control it. And if you can do that and you can control your mind, that's great. I never found that helpful. So I find that we can get to the same place, which is samadhi, which is one-pointedness, which is a non-dualistic, very open and spacious state of mind by just really diligently letting go and letting go and letting go, particularly if we practice in retreat. And this is necessary because the right understanding that we are trying to get an experience of is not something that we can perceive as long as we're stuck in our discriminating mind, as long as we are just kind of it's you know, mental activity as usual. Our assumptions, our delusions are have too much control of us. But when we can allow some of that to settle and we can just be in a very different way, then this other way of perceiving this, these other truths can become obvious to us. And this, you know, just like I said at the beginning, this isn't just like when we're talking about right meditation, we're not just talking about sitting down like the Buddha did and overnight achieving complete perfect enlightenment. Like, we experience this at different stages, and really just a little bit of zazen can start making a difference in our lives. And that's what is happening, right? There's somehow that's a very different human activity. Just meditation is just unlike any other human activity. You're just putting everything down. You're doing something useless, completely useless with your mind. Whether you're concentrating or you're letting go, you are deliberately sitting there being useless. And it's different. It affects the mind and changes the mind and then feeds back into right understanding, and the whole wheel turns. So, yeah, I think I will leave it there. And we have a good 15 minutes or so to talk about comments or questions. And anybody?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So, regarding the idle chatter, I find myself that's something that I struggle with the most. And I think a part of it is with jokes. Like I find myself just like, you know, every like 10th thing might be pretty funny and like make somebody laugh pretty, you know, bring joy, be a good thing. But when it's not hitting, or when it's like not, when somebody's not really like, they're trying to focus on something, then I'm like, really, it's really like idle chatter. But I think when I picture the Buddha, I picture kind of a funny guy. Like, what
really?
What do you think? I mean, like joyful, like maybe he might not mean to make you laugh, but I picture if you spend time, maybe you'd laugh sometimes. I feel like you make me laugh sometimes. But you know, so where do jokes fit in with being a Buddha?
Well, and I mean, I think too, a similar question has arisen for me, just in terms of like, well, I mean, I don't really know how guys do it when they're all alone with guys, but like, I don't know, get together with women, just talk, right? Just talk and you might bitch about some stuff and you might, I don't know, like, and it's about, it's, you know, it can definitely be idle, but it also feels like a relationship maintenance. I don't know. So I feel like, and I don't really want to interpret these teachings in a really strict way. I mean, I think to say like, no, idle chatter would be similar to just like, well, like no sex at all. Like, you know, that's like the extreme, like you're going to go full monastic, renunciate, act this out literally. But it is useful to just ask that question, you know, at which point does this just not feel right anymore, right? At which point maybe is it just habit energy making you make the jokes, or maybe you're kind of nervous about the silence and just trying to fill it, or you know, there's stuff that isn't so helpful perhaps behind some of it. And then you're like, huh, interesting. And then sometimes it in the practice it can be helpful to just kind of stop and then, you know, see what happens and then kind of pick something up later in a more skillful way. Sometimes, I mean, you don't have to, but it like sometimes that helps clarify our relationship to something. So I've definitely went through a similar period where I recognized, I used to stick my foot in it quite a lot. And I'd be really sarcastic. And a lot of my sarcasm and humor was self-deprecating because that's kind of a safe territory, right? But at a certain point, I recognized, like, with more mindfulness, right? When we turn our mindfulness toward our behavior, it's kind of like, oh, that kind of hurts. You're constantly like bad mouthing yourself. Like, come on. Like, do I really think that? And then when other people would laugh, it would just encourage me, like, oh, yeah, I guess I do kind of suck. I guess I'm kind of a bitch. Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah. And like, so I really like made an effort to stop doing that. And for a while, I was like, kind of don't know what to say now. It was uncomfortable, but then new ways to interact came out of that, and they ended up being like, oh, you know, I can ask people about themselves more, I can pay more attention to what they're saying, I don't necessarily have to fill the space with something sarcastic. So yeah, it's rich practice.
That makes me feel better. I feel like I don't I don't have to just like quit saying jokes.
And I don't know, I picture the Buddha as pretty freaking serious, but I have known, fortunately, I've known many different like really senior Zen and Buddhist practitioners, and they're not all like, I think the Dalai Lama must be, I bet he's much more like lighthearted. It's funny.
This is just an example of something I experienced over the weekend, with the five things, maybe, you know, to figuring out if you're going to say anything at all. I was with friends on a trip and I found myself in the position where I was the mutual friend and these other girls didn't know each other. And I'm seeing, as the weekend went on, seeing these personalities kind of start to rub on each other. Like, oh, this is interesting. They don't know if they would be doing this if it wasn't for me, or like be in the same room or friends at all. And I started to feel this pressure to kind of play referee or to say something, because I felt tensions and like, oh, I want to like put it down. I want to like fix this. And I decided not to, because I felt like it would make it worse, and I'm not very graceful in that way. And what I realized was that my friends are fully functioning adults who can self-soothe. And I didn't have to do anything. And it just was, it was a very conscious decision of mine. And I felt it was just really good. And that's, I just thought I'd share that story.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's what practice gave me pretty much right away was, I mean, I felt like before practice, I just watched myself behave. Like, and I might even be just like, I don't even want to do that, but I keep doing that. And like, can I do anything about it? I don't know, apparently not. But then it's just like, I don't know, that, you know, sit a little zazen, you start this idea of mindfulness, and suddenly you're kind of like, huh, look what's happening right now. Maybe I could do something different. Anybody in the cloud, you're very welcome to unmute yourself, or you, under reactions, you can click the raise hand button and I will see your little raised hand. Veronica.
Just kind of a question, because like you already explained, there's not a lot of focus on the Eightfold Path. And, you know, when you're beginning, when you're reading all about the Eightfold Path, and it's complicated to understand. And so I appreciate you teaching about it. And then I found it kind of curious, because there's not a lot of attention on the Eightfold Path, but there seems to be quite a bit of attention on the precepts, which is almost like a wedge of the path. And so I guess, how did that come to be, that there's more attention on the precepts than on the Eightfold Path in Zen? Or
yeah, well, I mean, it's all there. I don't know why over the years, the Chinese folks kind of dispensed with the list, but like all the components are there. So I'm kind of writing this little outline of a basic teachings book that maybe someday I'll pull together. And I had this outline of like all these different important things that I would want to make sure to mention, right? my idea is that this isn't going to be too thick, right? It'd just be like, I'm brand new to practice. What should I read? Be like, here you go. And tonight, in preparation for this class, I kind of rearranged all those essential components according to the Eightfold Path. So, you know, in right understanding, you know, we talk about the teachings all the time. We study texts. You know, I've been doing a series, Awakening to Reality with a capital R. We talk about emptiness, these truths to which we are trying to awaken for ourselves. And then in right intention, we have the idea that of the mind that seeks the way, or bodhicitta, that, you know, at some point we say, you know, like I said, there's got to be a better way. And this determination to follow the path arises. So we have a lot of emphasis on bodhicitta and taking refuge in the three treasures. So like the precepts, you know, there's like the moral part, but then there's also the taking refuge part and the karma verse of like, you know, I take responsibility for all my past karma and stuff like that. So in some ways there's right intention. And we also honor the four Brahma Viharas, you know, metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So that's kind of this non-harming. And then, of course, like you said, we have ethical conduct. We got, you know, emphasize that quite a lot. And when it comes to right effort, I mean, in some ways, I might almost phrase that as like right practice from a Zen point of view. Like, I mean, I'm hoping that when you all, you know, go out to lunch or do Sangha check-in or something, we're talking about our practice. How is your practice? You know, and that to me is a very alive Zen thing. We each have a practice. We each have an effort that we're making. Some of it involves vows. Some of it involves taking the precepts or becoming a term student and making vows for the term, etc. So there's a lot about effort. We're just not talking necessarily labeling it that. And then right mindfulness, we definitely have emphasis on daily mindfulness. It's like kind of like Zazen off the cushion, right? Like really paying attention to what you do each moment. And then as I was saying, it's mindfulness goes beyond just that kind of moment to moment thing into study. And so we talk a lot about studying the self. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be, you know, actualized by all things. So really that's right in there with that right mindfulness, this study of the Dharma in our own experience. And then of course we have right meditation, Zazen and our retreats where we take that more deeply. So, you know, it's all there. We just don't label it in the same convenient way. I think, I don't know. It's like the Indians really love the lists and the Chinese got more kind of free form and poetic. But, you know, it's like we didn't throw anything away. So good question. Well, I guess that brings us just about to the end of the day. I offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parami. Thank you all for coming.